This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Maintaining bone strength is complex with no single solution. My patients who want to optimize their bone health have seen remarkable results with LiveMD as part of a comprehensive bone program. LiveMD is a Class 1 medical device cleared by the FDA. It creates a gentle, low-intensity vibration to benefit your musculoskeletal system. It's a safe, scientifically proven, and simple approach to maintaining musculoskeletal health and wellness. It really works, just 10 minutes per day. Go to livemd.us, that's livemd.us, to learn more about how LiveMD may improve your health. That's livemd.us. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. You can send your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com, and we reserve the right to edit or make your questions more concise, or if they're impossible to contend with, we may not answer them at all, because some questions just are, you know, they just... It's sort of like, here I am, you know, 4 pages long. Could you please fix me? No, we can't.
But we will condense your question into one sentence.
Exactly.
Where you may not recognize it anymore, okay?
Exactly. Or, you know, alternatively, you know, you can become a patient of the Hoffman Center or a patient of Layla's for any kind of complex medical situation. Or just, you know, if you send us a list of 14 different vitamins, should I be taking these? That, too. Is grist for the mill for medical consultation and not so much for a quick podcast turnaround answer. Okay, so nonetheless, here we be. And I got to tell you something very interesting I did this morning because I was, you know, I am a member of the media, and so I'm on some kind of mailing list from the American Museum of Natural History where they now have, check this out, they've got a new exhibit on the microbiome.
And, oh, wow.
And which is something we've been, obviously, we've been talking about this, what, you know, 10, 15 years, and it's getting a lot of attention. And I got to say, they did a really good job imparting this information in a form that lay persons and children can understand. And, you know, I think that the message at a children's level is that microbes can be our friends as well as our foes. So to get people away from that sort of that disinfectant mentality, you know, scrub, scrub, scrub away, and you know, spray Lysol on everything, and you know, sterilize everything.
Antibacterial soaps.
Yeah, yeah. So the message is that you know, they're good bacteria, they're bad bacteria, and you know, just a couple of tidbits because I wrote down some things. I took some notes when you know they gave a little presentation there. There are literally trillions of these bugs in our gastrointestinal tract. They way outnumber us.
We're more than the cells in our bodies.
Yes, by far. We're only 10% human.
Oh.
But even more impressive, 95% to 99% of the genes in our body are microbial genes. The genes are present throughout our gastrointestinal tract. 99% of the bugs are in our gut. 1% of them are on our skin surfaces, perhaps, you know, in our mouth, our genital areas. But that if we were to take all the germs that our body harbors and put them in a bucket, that would weigh 2 to 3 pounds. And so it's actually like a separate organ, a considerable large size organ. It's actually equivalent to the weight of the human brain. And probably has more cells for sure than the human brain. And so some interesting stuff on that. Also, one of the things that I learned was that, and they actually have little side exhibits and with little factoids, is that if you are treated for H. pylori, which is a common thing, sometimes, and doctors erroneously do this, they screen people for H. pylori, even if they don't have ulcers. I mean, one thing, if you have an ulcer, it's not going away. Maybe you should be treated for H. pylori. We like to treat it naturally. They like to treat it with antibiotics. But now it's pretty common that they'll screen you for H. pylori in the belief that H. pylori is it's cancer-causing. Well, okay, rarely it can cause or contribute to gastric cancer. And so that's not a rationale for dosing everybody with powerful antibiotics to get rid of it. In fact, what that can do is it can make you gain weight. And specifically, it has been found that H. pylori suppresses ghrelin. Ghrelin, G-H-R-E-L-I-N, I'm sure you're familiar with Layla, but some of our listeners are not, is an appetite-inducing hormone. And it kind of like, the way to remember that is, you know, when your stomach growls, that's ghrelin, okay?
Yes.
Make up a little mnemonic device for that. It's the thing that increases your cravings for food.
And so the treatment increases ghrelin.
The treatment actually increases the appetite stimulating hormone.
Yeah.
You know, for some reason, and this may be, you know, it's not nice to fool with Mother Nature, is that maybe nature provided us with these bugs to keep things in balance and to send signals to our immune system, to send signals to our appetite system, to our brains. There's even a section on the gut-brain syndrome, the gut-brain connection in this exhibit. And it's a great, you know, for those who are in the New York area, or if you're coming to New York, maybe with your family, with your kids, and you want to introduce them to this concept in a fun way, you know, it's a exhibit that you could take in an hour. If you go to the American Museum of Natural History, then you could take a side trip and you can see the dinosaur skeletons and have a nice family day.
It's always a wonderful museum to visit.
Yeah, it's so much. Yeah. It's so much there. I mean, you obviously can't take it all in one day. It's it's just capacious, huge museum. But you know, I really appreciate that they are taking on this very important subject, and they say that I'm quoting from one of their introductory talks. They say this is one of the most exciting fields in health and medicine because, and in fact, you know, we characterize the Human Genome Project, which is an amazing accomplishment. So far, the practical implications have not been very great there. I mean, not that they won't be in the future, because maybe we'll be able to fix faulty genes and engineer, you know, solutions to genetic diseases. But so far, you know, not a big splash in terms of our clinical applications, but the microbiome, there are day-to-day applications, you know, in terms of like, you know, what household products you use, you know, how, you know, what you do when you have a minor infection. Do you run to the doctor and get a broad spectrum antibiotic, or do you try to use like a homeopathic remedy or a natural remedy?
Or just changing your diet will change your microbiome.
Huge, absolutely, because you know sugar and refined foods create just fuel the overgrowth of bad bacteria, and conversely, high fiber foods that contain prebiotics, things like beans and
asparagus and leeks and onions and garlic.
And artichoke. Mm. I just had some nice marinated artichoke for lunch. You know, so these are just some take-home messages, news you can use. They talk about probiotics. They don't say that probiotics have the answers yet, but they discuss, you know, the role that probiotics might play. And, you know, the truth is we don't know the answer. You know, are there miracle probiotics that make you lose weight or enhance your immunity or reduce your risk of urinary tract infections or can combat yeast infections, can cure depression, can cure ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease? We don't have the answers yet. But, you know, the research, man, there's so many people working on this. It is really a hot field. Very, very gratifying.
That's very interesting about the H. pylori and the ghrelin, the increase in ghrelin, which makes us growl with hunger and all of that. I wonder if the animal meat industry
it's part of the way that they fatten up animals and fatten us up, but maybe only just part. So, all right, let's get to questions with that preamble.
Okay. I've got a question from Karen. Who says, I just received an email from Consumer Labs warning of a Canadian study on the possibility of cardiovascular problems arising with strontium. I started taking two capsules of the citrate form, and my bone density improved.
Right.
My father and grandfather have cardiovascular problems, and my mom has phlebitis. Should I be concerned?
Okay. We are well aware of these reports.
Yeah.
And, you know, the material that this person sent, because I looked at this letter, specifically says that this does not apply to strontium that's sold as supplements. There has been no recorded episode of problems with strontium citrate or strontium carbonate or strontium lactate. I think we use the strontium citrate, I think.
Citrate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And at any doses. In Europe, when they use high doses of the drug, strontium ranelate, there have been rarely some episodes of, they think, cardiovascular events that may be due to thickening of the blood. Mm-hmm. But it's, to me, it's pretty clear that it's not about the strontium, it's about the ranelate. Notwithstanding that, what I've been doing is, as a caution, in people who have very high risk of heart disease, you know, they've had a recent heart attack, or maybe they've had multiple blood clots, I have been saying, you know, just in case, maybe we'll try alternative methods of working with bone density. We've discovered that ostanol is a very potent bone builder. So for people who either prefer not to take strontium or strontium is a concern, they can take ostanol, O-S-T-I-N-O-L, where there are no contraindications in terms of cardiovascular disease.
Yeah.
And it's a completely different thing. Ostanol is a bone morphogenetic protein. We actually did an entire podcast on the subject that you can dial up at drhoffman.com. And quite interesting discussion with James Scafidi on that.
So, the distinction has to be made. It's the prescription form of strontium, which is strontium ranelate, and they specify there are no reports of cardiovascular risk at the supplement dose. That's strontium citrate, strontium gluconate, or lactate.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fine.
And
yeah.
Let me also just say that this emanates from Consumer Lab. I'm quarreling with the proposition that in Europe, with the drug, they have some cautions about the use of drug. By the way, they didn't take the drug off the market. They just said caution, okay? Use it cautiously. Mm-hmm. Think of how many drugs that are approved in America. They're cautions. I mean, you see every time you see an ad on TV, you see like 49 different things that it could cause. Rarely.
Which are worse than the original medical condition anyway. It's like, why bother?
Right. But strontium is powerful. It's a drug. There's a drug-like effect. And, you know, as I think I mentioned in last week's podcast, we had a patient who came in with an astounding improvement with strontium. It was like a 30-plus percent improvement in just 2 years in bone density in her spine and a 20-plus percent in her hips. And
that was amazing.
She was delighted.
See that report,
really delighted. She went from, pretty serious osteoporosis to mild to moderate osteopenia. Just completely flipped the script on that. So,
and this is a woman in her late 60s.
Right.
So, you know, this is where it's prevalent, osteoporosis. So,
Consumer Lab tends to be a little alarmist, and a lot of people in the supplement industry feel that they've been given an unfair shake by Consumer Lab, because Consumer Lab tests products sometimes without an understanding of how to properly assay the products. And they will sometimes disapprove a product or knock a product based on a test methodology that's not appropriate to the product. So we've had some problems with Consumer Lab's analysis in the past. I mean, I think it's good that there is a, like kind of a Consumer Reports for vitamins, an independent organization. But I got to say, they're kind of disappointing sometimes in their conclusions. Fortunately, most of the supplements that I've made or been involved with, you know, I was making supplements at the vitamin shop, they passed muster. And, so I was happy to see that. But if they had said that, chances are if they'd said, well, the potency isn't right, or, you know, it's not bioavailable, or there's something wrong with it, usually there's an explanation, and they're not necessarily the arbiter of final truth on the usefulness of supplements.
Dr. Hoffman, I used to be a subscriber to Consumer Reports, you know, what's the best model car, what kind of washing machine, all of that, yada, yada. But I was very, very disappointed when I read an article about, you know, they took all the bad research about vitamins are bad, vitamins can kill, and
right.
they put all that in there. And that's mm-hmm. when I said, you know what? I'm done with the subscription.
Yeah,
because it's unfortunate that they did that. Yeah,
it's a faintly anti-supplement bias,
mm-hmm.
and they love to kind of create alarmist and lurid headlines about supplements. Now,
yeah.
look, I'm all over this strontium story, and when I prescribe it and I recommend it to our listeners, I take a lot of responsibility. But I see nothing at this point, and I want to emphasize this. To suggest that people should stop taking strontium, the over-the-counter kind,
mm-hmm.
you know, pending any, mm-hmm. you know, we always keep our eyes and ears open, but there's no information to suggest that the experience with a supplement is going to parallel the experience with the medication in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So, setting the record straight on strontium.
Yep.
Thank you, Karen, for your very, very important question.
Yeah, it's very important
to
talk about this. Yep. And I've talked about it on my weekly radio program as well, because I think we need to get the word out about this. Strontium is a marvelous way of enhancing bone density, and it would be a shame to have to forego that important tool in our repertoire against osteoporosis, especially since the medications themselves have such potentially bad side effects. We know that the medications, not always, but sometimes, have pretty bad side effects. So, on the basis of that,
of the bisphosphonates,
right? To forego the use of something benign, and then go to a medication, to me doesn't make a lot of sense.
It doesn't make any sense. You know, to risk with bisphosphonates having freaky fractures, you know, that fracture in your thigh bone for no good reason,
mm-hmm.
and the necrosis of the jaw. I know for dentists, it's regular intake now. Are you taking any osteoporosis medications and so forth? Because they see it on the x-rays. They see the diminished bone. Anyway.
And 5 years ago, I had to be that person because people would say, well, I'm having dental implants put in. Do you think that's a good idea? And I said, well, aren't you on Fosamax, Actonel, or Beneva? Yeah. I said, well, didn't your dentist ask you? But no, because that awareness wasn't there until there were some horrible consequences. And now dentists are in a kind of a CYA mode about that because they know that if they don't ask the proper questions and they undertake very invasive dental procedures in people taking these powerful drugs, that the healing of the jaw will be impaired and you can actually trigger a massive destruction of bone in the jaw. So anyway, enough on that subject. But
Okay. We've got a question from Tanya, and she says, I've been having some bad pains in my stomach after I eat. It started 2 years ago, so I had my gallbladder removed, and I was so happy.
Yeah.
So, well, about a month after, the pains came back.
Mm-hmm.
The doctors can't find anything wrong with me.
Oh, boy.
And in addition, I'm trying to lose weight, and I'm not able to.
Yeah. Mm. So, okay, well, this is sometimes referred to as post-cholecystectomy syndrome. Which may mean that the problem wasn't the gallbladder, and that there's still some inflammation in the biliary tract. Okay, that's one thing that can happen. The other thing that can happen is that all along the problem really wasn't the gallbladder, and it might have been something else. It might have been bacterial overgrowth in the small intestine, irritable bowel syndrome, or something. Sometimes they'll say, you've got a lot of pain and you have stones. Well, a lot of people have stones, and the stones don't cause any problems. So they say, well, if we see stones and you've got problems, we'll take your gallbladder out on the chance that you might get better, but you might also be left high and dry because removal of gallbladder doesn't solve all gastrointestinal problems. So whether this is a sequel to a gallbladder problem or it never was a gallbladder problem is unclear, And this is the kind of person who needs to undertake a major diet change. Hey, you know, one of the problems that happens when people have gallbladder disease, they really limit their diet. They eat very carefully because they know that eating wrong is going to trigger a very painful gallbladder attack. It is not uncommon to see people after their gallbladder comes out for them to gain weight because they don't have any pain anymore. They can eat like a house on fire, you know, and they have no breaks. I mean, it's no more warning light that, hey, maybe you shouldn't eaten that. You shouldn't have eaten that. So, I don't know what's happening with this person specifically.
She needs a complete workup. If she's having stomach pain after she eats, she could be allergic to whatever she's eating.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what she's eating.
Yeah.
So there could be that. It could be bacterial. It could be any number of things.
Yeah.
So
you had a SIBO patient yesterday, right? That wasn't
My
patient, your own patient, but you were astute and you administered the test and it was very high with that patient.
Right. I have this patient come in. She's a woman in her 60s. She came to see me originally a month ago. She's waking up every morning with a terrible taste in her mouth and chronic, chronic bloating.
Mm-hmm.
She's been seeing a gastroenterologist for 4 years.
Yeah.
Has not been helped. Was given Prilosec, Nexium, all
of
this.
Of course, right. Yeah.
I gave her a SIBO test.
Yeah.
She has SIBO. You and I looked at the test the other day. It was off the charts.
Off the charts, yeah.
And now she's so happy because she's already starting to feel better.
Right.
With the treatment, so this
with
is
diet
very
change, certain certain herbal, natural antibacterials and probiotics, presumably, you're giving her?
Yes, yes. Okay. I'm giving her Candibactin. I'm giving her some probiotics to reinoculate. I've got her on a very anti-fermentable, anti-inflammatory SCD-type diet to help with the SIBO. So she's on her way.
Doesn't make you feel good when, you know, you can provide a different perspective because I'm not knocking conventional medicine because conventional medicine does marvelous things, but there is a gap, and this is where, talented, innovative nutritionists like you can fill the gap, or nutritionally oriented physicians like me can sometimes discern where conventional medicine leaves off and where a more, shall we say, comprehensive approach can yield an answer. So it's really great.
Yeah, it is wonderful.
Okay, this is a good point at which to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. Let us pause at this point. Give us a preview of what we're going to talk about in part two.
When I get sleepy after a meal, should I take a nap or take a walk?
That's a great question. That's kind of a philosophical question.
Yeah.
Give in or, fend it off. All right. Stay tuned for an answer to that important question. Great practical import. We've all been there. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.